time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking a part of this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
This government has put record amounts of funding into the NHS, and when it comes to mental health, we are making mental health on parity with physical health, so that the funding there is increasing, and we have seen record levels of money going into...
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday, the 27th of January, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, we are surrounded by liars everywhere, from Suella Braverman lying on BBC Question Time, to the BBC itself lying in its coverage of what's going on in Venezuela, to Mr. Paul Mason increasingly looking like he's lying about being a Corbyn supporter with his stance on the EU. Yes, we're surrounded by fibbers, cheats, and charlatans. But don't you worry, no lies here, just the whole truth and nothing but the truth, Your Honour, in this week's Topple Uncaged. Of course, I'll be doing my usual quickfire roundup on Plucked News. I've got a fantastic campaigner joining me for Free Flying With. I'll be giving you the quickest roundup of BBC Question Time and also asking some questions I would be if I was in the audience. And I've got a fantastic international music guest this week on Revolutionary Birdsong. So, don't worry about anything. I will be giving you the full picture of this week's top stories. Cue Fleetwood Mac. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. Yes, this is, of course, the quickest news roundup in the UK. It's time for Plucked News. Five news stories, 5 minutes. Can I fit them all in? Yes, of course I can. Are you ready? Steady? Let's go. And of course, it would be remiss of me not to start off with Brexit, the story one. And where to begin? Theresa Mann's Plan A was apparently turning into Plan B on Monday when she brought it to Parliament. The only difference was, of course, waiving the £65 fee for EU nationals to register here after Brexit. So she effectively changed the dictionary and made A into B or B into A or whatever. I think it's nearly as much of a mess as Brexit is generally. Then you had the DUP come out and say they would be backing this deal to stop the Ramonas. Meanwhile, the Irish came out and said there would be soldiers needed on their border. Blair came out and said Brexit was a complete mess. And Gavin, don't tell Alan Pike Williamson came out and said he's going to call up the army reserves in the event of a no-deal Brexit. No hint of irony there. Hey, Private Pike Williamson, I hope they've got their scarves, Uncle Arthur. I'd like to say roll on the 29th of March, but as things proceed, it looks more and more unlikely that we're actually going to Brexit on that day anyway. And for story number two, I'm off to BBC News, and they reported that experts call for review of quake limits on UK fracking. This is a staggering story. The British Geological Survey, who track and monitor seismic activity in the UK, have said that they think the government should increase the traffic light system past the 0.5 magnitude, which is the scale on which frackers have to stop fracking if this occurs, and put it up to 1.5 magnitude as the top limit. Of course, the background to this is Quadrilla have been fracking at Preston New Road in Lancashire, and since October, we've seen more than 50 earthquakes, some of them up to a 1.5 magnitude tremor. Now, my mates at Frack Free Lancashire say this reeks of cronyism, essentially that the British Geological Survey are bowing to the whims of the fracking industry and the government. But oddly, the government has maintained its stance that it is not going to adjust the traffic light system. Of course, the problem with this is it all flies in the face of up-and-coming evidence, which is getting more and more prevalent. For example, Stanford University, which has done research which says that minor tremors can lead to larger earthquakes, and they studied this in the US where fracking is a huge industry. And even the former government advisor Peter Stiles has come out and said that fracking poses a major risk in certain areas, specifically where coal mining has been done before. What are the British Geological Survey up to? Methinks they're probably getting into bed with the British fracking industry. I hope you enjoy your noshing off of those shale gas extractors, the BSG, because your cronyism now absolutely stinks. And for story number three, I'm off to The Guardian, and they reported that I've absolutely had enough. No, this wasn't Theresa May and Brexit. This is Tory MP embarking on an anti-austerity tour. This is the news that Tory MP Heidi Allen has teamed up with the other Tory MP Frank Field. Oh, sorry, Labour MP Frank Field. To go on an austerity tour of Britain to see the absolute devastation that 8 years of cuts is imposing on British society. Where to begin with this bullshit? Firstly, Heidi Allen and Frank Field are exactly two peas in a pod, quite frankly. While Frank Field may be a Labour MP, This is the man who infamously said that troublesome families in his constituency should be housed in metal containers under a motorway. And Heidi Allen, for all her tears, is essentially still a Tory. She still votes with their party. She still maintains membership. If she was that fucking bothered, why not resign the whip and go independent? But for me, it's staggering that two senior MPs in the two main parties feel the need to go on the tour of the UK to see the impact of the cuts. If they wanted to know the impact of cuts, all they have to do is look at the past 8 years. And the horror stories that the mainstream media have now become accustomed to trotting out all the time. But ultimately, this stinks of fucking political opportunism. Heidi Allen, Frankfield, you're a disgrace. If you really want to go on an anti-austerity tour, why not go to some of the offshore tax havens that some of your MPs and businesses you support flout the rules with and take money out of this country? Now, story number four, and I'm back to BBC News, and they reported that cervical smearing, millions missing smear tests. This is about a survey by a cervical cancer charity which found that around 3 million women across England had not had a smear test for at least 3.5 years. But moreover, what this survey found and what was reported was the attitudes to smear testing. It reportedly said that a large proportion of women are embarrassed to have a smear test, and that's why they're not going. I can see where this is leading. No, never mind the fact that Capita runs smear testing in England, and that 50,000 women either missed appointments or were not sent out results because of their blunder. No, it's nothing to do with the fact that in Northern Ireland it's also a privatised service where 6,000 women were tested with out-of-date kits. No, of course, women not getting smear tested has got nothing to do with that. It's all their fault. It's because they're embarrassed. See what's going on here? They're pushing the onus once again onto patients. It's your responsibility. It's your fault you're not getting smear tested. Nothing to do with our dodgy mates in the private sector fucking everything up. Smear testing in this country is absolute bedlam. I dread to think how many women have not got the correct diagnosis in time because of the chaos in this now business. And finally, for story number five, I'm off to my home, the Canary, and Tracy Keeling, my good mate, reported that the BBC just put out its most grotesque pro-regime change propaganda since the invasion of Iraq. Now, unless you've been on another planet or you've been reading the mainstream press, you won't have missed the fact that there is a coup going on in Venezuela at this moment. Yes, the opposition leader is basically trying to overthrow the sitting President Maduro. Now, the BBC essentially reported that the US was forced to get involved and forced to pick a side with this, but as Tracy quite rightly pointed out for one specific segment, the BBC is up to its old tricks again, essentially. Supporting the establishment nine and not giving people the full facts. Full facts like Venezuela has the most oil reserves on the planet. And of course, with the socialist government in charge, the US and other Western countries ain't going to be able to get their hands on them. This is the BBC at its absolute worst. But as Tracy quite rightly pointed out, we were here with the Iraq war. We've been there with Libya. We've been there with Afghanistan. We've been there with Syria. And now we're seeing it with Venezuela. Do you pay your license fee? If you do, I think maybe we should all consider a mass boycott. It's well overdue. And hadn't even had time to mention the massive debate that happened in Parliament on Thursday, 24th of January, into myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly known as ME. Big thanks to SNP MP Carol Monaghan for chairing that debate. This was crucial. There are at least 250,000 people in this country, if not more, living with ME, and this is the first time this has had a full parliamentary debate. You need to check out the timelines of ME Association and ME Action to find out what happened during this debate. But let me tell you this. This is a massive scandal that has worldwide implications, and you need to start getting all over this, people. Nor have I got time to mention serial Blairite and all-around charity con David Miliband suddenly putting an appearance this week. Not only was he to be found at Davos, where he was representing his NGO, saying he was trying to force corporations and governments to act on the refugee crisis, more like he wanted more fucking money for his company, but he also started harping on about Brexit. And what with the other laughable brother, Ed Miliband, back this week, poking his nose into HS2, I do have to ask myself, why can't this pair just stay buried? And I haven't even got time to mention U2's Bono being at Davos this week, coming out moaning about capitalism again, saying how it's amoral. This is, of course, the very same Bono who tax avoids on an industrial scale and has worked for every crony capitalist record label going. A-list celebrity, you're a grade-A hypocrite, Bono. I haven't really got time, but I'm going to mention it. The BBC are thinking of moving an office to Europe because of Brexit. I have one thing to say to that. Fuckety-bye, then. And I shouldn't mention, but I need to mention it because it's so ridiculous. The Queen came out this week and apparently made comments about Brexit. Yes, she's been sticking her oar into this. Much like the BBC, I have one thing to say to you, Queenie. Off with their heads. And that's it for this week's edition of Pluck News. Coming up now. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, Free Flying with... My next guest is becoming a bit of a topple uncaged regular. Yes, she is a leading disability rights campaigner in this country. She is a very good friend of mine, and she is a force to be reckoned with. It is the legendary Paula Peters. Paula, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast for a second time.
It's an absolute pleasure, Steve, and hello to everybody listening in.
Thank you. It's so great to have you on the going. So we always have excellent discussions, so I'm looking forward to this one. We're going to kick off, as always, with three stories, one of which was chosen by Paula, one of which was chosen by my good self and one of which was thrown open to the Twitterati and who have been voting in their hundreds. So, Paula, to kick us off, this is a story from you. Now, I'm not 100% genned up on this story, so you're going to have to do the explainer. But on Tuesday, there was a meeting of the Public and Commercial Services Union regarding the Department for Work and Pensions. Now, historically, in my opinion, the PCS Union have not been very good on DWP issues, but they had this meeting and they produced a pamphlet detailing their thoughts on the DWP and how it needs to be reformed moving forward. Paula, over to you, because you were at this meeting. What happened? What's your take on the PCS Union's position?
So they had this meeting, which you found about on Facebook, called the Future of Social Security, and the DWP Working Group and the PCS Union brought about this booklet, which is available online, The Future of Social Security. So it's basically, half of it is historical, the building of the welfare state and what's happened to it since before Thatcher's time, and the dismantling over 40 years, basically, And the increasing neoliberal agenda and capitalism and austerity, which has impacted on the welfare state. And then there was a pamphlet, basically a couple of paragraphs on universal credit.
Okay.
Now, at the meeting, the PCS did actually say, and this come from Mark Sawatka, the General Secretary, who started his career as a office clerk in a job centre in South Wales.
I didn't know that. Who are?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Okay. So he was actually from the shop floor, and basically the only General Secretary to actually have come from the shop floor, if you want.
Mm.
So he was actually frontline staff. And he actually said that at the meeting, that the union agreed with the stop and scrap position, and It should be pointed out that 42% of the DWP staff will also be heading on to universal credit and going through all the rigmarole of this as well. I think that's really important to stress.
Yeah.
But in their leaflet, it said, stop the rollout. Now, that is a jumping point for them to campaign on, because they actually said that, you know, that the Tory government have put billions into the universal credit program and they're not going to stop it or do anything to it while they are in government.
Yeah.
So their campaign position is to stop the rollout, but they actually say it needs to be stopped and scrapped.
Right.
And we need to come together to find a workable way forward.
That all sounds lovely, doesn't it? That's all well and good. Is that as cut and dried as it sounds, Paula? Are the PCS Union now on side?
I would say they're hedging that way, but more work still needs to be done within the PCS Union. And what we need to do is literally we need to have meetings with the members, especially the grassroots members who are instrumental in applying universal credit out in the job centres, and also with the DWP Working Group to kind of really push this position of stop and scrap. I mean, they say it at a meeting, but the pamphlet says stop the rollout, so it's not saying scrap.
Right.
And I think more needs to be done within the union, but also for us as campaigners to really push their position into stop and scrap. But the comment Mark Sawatka brought up about the government's put billions into this, which they have. I mean, they flooded money at Universal Credit. You know, what I'd say to everybody out there is we have still got to keep the campaigns going, no matter how hard it is.
To keep
the momentum going, raise awareness of what Universal Credit is doing to people out there, but also to all the trade unions. This is affecting in-work people as well, those on low income, 0 hours contracts and everything, and the trade union reps are absolutely clueless about what's to come. They're going to have members coming to them and saying, well, I've just been told I've got to apply for universal credit. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And this is working tax credits, child tax credits, you know, the DWP are coming for that.
What also happened, of course, with universal credit this week was that a two-day court hearing happened over three claimants in two separate cases represented by the Child Poverty Action Group. Now, the basic nuts and bolts of this are essentially there were three claimants, a mother and a daughter with one case and a woman with another case. both with living with impairments, and their challenge was that they lost out money under universal credit due to the setup and due to the fact that the government has put in some transitional protections, but what these cases highlighted was that some of them aren't actually adequate at all, and we're not going to get the result of that yet. It was just a two-day hearing. What the hell are we going to do about universal credit, Paula?
Right, to be honest, I think, you know, while we've got this Conservative government in place, you know, with the DUP, they're pushing ahead regardless, you know, they're not listening to anything or anybody, you know, and whenever court case, they just tinker with the guidelines, which means they don't actually have to take those through Parliament to do that. They can just tinker with it, change a word here or there, and that's how people are losing their support. I think, honestly, as more and more in work people are affected, those on working tax credits, child tax credits, have housing benefits to top up their rent, as more of these, this group are affected by universal credit, I think the anger's there, but you're going to see a huge spike in anger, people having no money, being sanctioned, you know, working 16 hours, told to work 32, can't do that, can't meet childcare costs. And I think that's where we need to tap into a lot more of, you know, the in-work claimants group. Many of those are members of trade unions and say, look, get behind the Stop and Scrap campaign and let's build this into a really hard-hitting, sustained campaign where we can really push, because the government's under pressure, and this is one issue they're really coming under fire on is universal credit. And I think this, along with Brexit, these are the two stumbling blocks that really could really hit the Tories and really bring them down. But we've got to come together.
Yep.
In-work claimants, out-work claimants, and fight together on this
issue. Indeed, that's crucial. And just to interrupt you, that was a point you kind of began on in the last section, but I want to touch on again. Obviously, the PCS union's position, if they confirm that it is stop and scrap, not just stop the rollout, is interesting. But as you quite rightly pointed out, trade unions, and we discussed this the last time you were on this bloody podcast, Paula, and we're still in the same position, that trade unions are not geared up for the fact that hundreds and hundreds of thousands of their members and millions of their workers are going to be on universal credit. I mean, July 2019, we're now obviously seeing the 10,000 claimant trial begin of managed migration. So a good percentage of those managed migrants are going to be members of trade unions or people who should be represented by trade unions. How are we going to get the trade unions to actually wake up to this?
We've done some work in Bromley where we had a training day with trade union reps who are now going to become advocates. We work with Bromley Unite and other local groups to train people about universal credit. And this is something I've always advocated, that local groups and trade union reps and everything need to be trained up around what people's rights are about universal credit, how to support people going through the process to fill out these online forms, which are an absolute nightmare, and, you know, online's completely inaccessible for many people. And I think, you know, Gail Ward's project, the Hand to Mouth project she's been doing about universal credit and the training, with the training videos and the guides and everything, you know, 10 quid for these, and, you know, train people up. The most important thing is passing the knowledge on to other people and getting people trained up. And I think the more fit people you get trained up in these things, because they, you know, the local welfare advisors services are going, the COB's been ripped to bits, you know, and the law centres are going, it's going to be down to all of us in the local communities to get trained up. And that's part of campaigning.
Absolutely.
The only way you can take the government on is to learn the law, to know the law, to know how to change it. And that's something we've got to do a lot more of, I think.
Yeah, and that is absolutely crucial, because I'm in full agreement with you. We are now at a position with universal credit where it has to come down to us and communities and community grassroots action on this, which leads us into our next and final story, actually, quite nicely. The Evening Standard reported this week that knife crime statistics show that there are now 40 stabbings or sharp object related incidents in London a day. Now, I've said in the past, and I'll say it again, that while these figures are damning, and obviously it's a terrible position that we're in with regards to the violence on our streets, it is not as bad as it was under Tony Blair. However, the problem is it's growing, and we are seeing an increase in this. Do you think the approach of the Met and also the approach of Sadiq Khan and Labour and Green Party councillors and Assembly members in London is enough?
For the Met to Seine crew stop and search, there's been, especially in the BME community, there's huge amounts of anger around stop and search because, you know, a member of the BME community is just walking along the street, they're not doing anything, and they're stopped and they're searched by a cop. And there's huge mistrust in because of that with the police, and they're fueling mistrust. I think we've got to get out, and it's hard to do this, but we've got to get out and reach across the divide into our communities, many of whom are on their knees, driven by austerity cuts. Mm-hmm. You know, they've lost their youth centres, they've lost their sports centres, they've lost a lot of services that could support members of the community to get involved in other ways. There's huge amounts of anger, and of course, you know, many are driven by, you know, poverty's fueling a lot of anger out there and everything like that. You know, there's no support in the schools, the system's been stripped away. And this is something we've got to reach out across the divides, I think, and try and work with people. And I think some of the communities have been doing that by setting up, you know, community football groups and everything to try and spur them away from knife crime and, you know, channel them into another way. But I think, you know, the Met Police need to stop increasing stop and search, and it's just going to cause further division, further mistrust and further anger. And it's not going to stop knife crime. Just not going to do that.
No, absolutely.
They're not tackling the root of why it's increasing. They're actually just scratching that, oh, let's just do this. This will put a sticking plaster on it, and it won't. It will cause further division.
No, that's exactly so. And this is the challenge. It is essentially a sticking plaster. I mean, but for this week, Paula, that's an issue we can't solve. However, I hope we've shed some light for our listeners on other issues, especially surrounding universal credit. Paula, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Steve, it's
lovely to speak to you. Excellent.
Likewise.
Thank you, my darling.
You're welcome.
Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Topple chirps back. Well, question time this week was a bit more of a sober affair. After the previous episode with the furore surrounding Diane Abbott's abuse and the polling, more on that later. But it has to be said, Fiona Bruce is turning this into more of a Jerry Springer format as time passes. It's getting more and more Channel 5-esque right before our eyes. For me, the biggest gaffe, or rather biggest expose this week, was the fact that the head of Cicero Group said in the previous section that James Dyson, tax avoidance, moving his business elsewhere, absolutely outrageous. But then, of course, Fiona Bruce let slip that a guy from Cicero has just opened an island in Dublin. If that ain't about tax avoidance, I don't know what is. Anyway, on to next week's question. So what have you got for me, question time? First one, please.
Will the country stomach a delay to Brexit beyond March the 29th?
I think the audience reaction to this question was kind of quite telling, as it were. But then this is the question time audience, so it's probably chock full of Tory, Labour councillors and members of UKIP. But the problem is the question was put in the context of the Tory Brexit. Now, if Theresa May gave us a clean cut from the EU, none of this half-in, half-out, shake-it-all-round, hokey-cokey measures that she's currently proposing, then maybe there wouldn't be so much of an issue, because the Ramonas, as it were, and the people calling for a people's vote could have nothing to say, because that was, of course, what people voted for, and people who were wanting to leave the EU would be satisfied. But that is, of course, not going to happen. We are already a very divided society over this. I was just talking about it with Nicola the other night, actually, and she quite rightly pointed out this was always her fear with Brexit, that it was going to embolden the far right, and that is exactly what has happened. So I think any extension to leaving the EU and Article 50 is not for the best at all. Next question, please.
What should be done to protect young people from inappropriate social media content to help reduce levels of suicide and self-harm?
This is a very difficult one. I am all for freedom of speech, and I do not think that the internet should be restricted in any way. We already see enough political correctness gone mad with what we can and can't say in the public arena. However, there is an argument for the fact that social media companies have turned essentially into publishers now, and therefore they have a responsibility over their content. But the broader issue for me is not whether social media companies should be policing their websites to try and prevent people taking their own lives. I hate to sound like the government, but this is a complex issue. And a person seeing something on social media would be the spark that finishes off the flame that was already lit in the first place. We can talk about cuts to mental health services, we can talk about the lack of mental health support in education, but ultimately, why have we got this mental health crisis? I'm with the likes of Dr. Gabor Maté and Johan Harry, the journalist, on this. We have a mental health crisis because of capitalism. It is the system we live under that is causing so many people to be in mental distress. However, that is something that is never addressed within the political discourse. Until we change the system, this is going to continue, and it is essentially sticking plasters on a broken leg. Final question, please.
At what age should one no longer be allowed to drive?
Oh, this is easy. Anyone over a certain age, namely retirement age, should have mandatory retesting at least every couple of years. But moreover, with Phil the Greek. What was he doing driving without security anyway? And why does he think he can drive without a seatbelt on? I hate to sound like a broken record, but you know my view on the royal family. Off with their heads! Now, as always every week, here are the questions that I would put to the panel if I was sitting in the Question Time audience. Firstly, with Airbus's very aggressive statement this week in regards to no-deal Brexit and how it might move some of its operations offshore. Also, the car industry issuing warnings about how they'll scarper if Britain crashes out of the EU. And with Hitachi pulling out of the nuclear power plant in Anglesey. Is this actually all Brexit-related? Or are we seeing the symptoms of three industries which know they are dying a death due to climate change and the fact they're very unsustainable? And are they hedging their bets and winding down their operations or frantically thrashing around trying to find a quick profit where they can? My money's on that one. Secondly, I would like to know about Amber Rudd, please, this week, Question Time. Why has she come out and said in the event of a no-deal Brexit, she might quit the cabinet? Is it because she really cares so much about the UK and how she wants the best deal for it? Or is it because she's fucking bitten off more than she can chew like every other DWP secretary since Ian Duncan Smith and wants to abandon ship? Abandon ship! I think it's probably that. And finally, I would pose to the Question Time panel, Fiona, Jerry Springer, Bruce, and her half-baked non-apology about the polling furore last week with Diane Abbott. Do you think it's acceptable to slide this apology for such a major gaffe, or rather intentional propaganda, on your part into the show halfway through so nobody will notice? And moreover, do you think the damage was already done by the fact that you put out this erroneous information backing up rabid right-wing spectator columnist Isabel Oakeshott last week? And moreover, do you actually give a shit? Probably not. Thank you so much, Question Time. That's all from me this week. I look forward to watching your trash again next Thursday. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. As regular listeners to this podcast will know, I'm a bit of a fan of the Roots revival reggae movement that is coming out of Jamaica at the minute. It was huge last year, and I think this year, 2019, it is really going to blow up. There is some absolutely staggeringly good sounds, music, lyrics coming out of the country at the minute. None more so than my next guest, who I am so excited to have on here, because this album is absolutely staggering. I don't know where to begin to describe it, really, but it is staggering. And this is Bay C. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, man, give thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation. Shout out to the listeners. And thanks for this that compliment to the album. I really appreciate it.
I haven't even started yet. So, this album, I don't even want to call it an album, really. I don't want to call it an album because it's not an album. It is a massive project, if you like, really, because it started all the way back in 2012. And what you've created is there's 10 tracks plus an interlude, but there's a music video for each track, and you've literally been globe hopping, traveling across the world, filming these videos, getting inspiration. And the album itself is a massively eclectic mix of all types of music. We go from sort of roots reggae, then we throw some dancehall in, then I'm hearing a bit of sort of Afrobeat R&B, then we get stung with some hip-hop, and there's a sort of Middle Eastern vibe running through it as well. Was this eclecticness, basically, did it come out of your travels, or was it a kind of conscious decision to make a project that was so diverse in nature musically?
Well, I think the album is just a reflection of my taste in music and back before this project. It probably goes as far back as being a child and different musical influences from, you know, like I'm a big fan of hip-hop, of dancehall. Also, like, you know, I was growing up listening to The Doors, you know what I mean, listening to Fleetwood Mac, you know what I mean? So it's really all the different influences, and the fact that I'm doing a body of work that represents me, I chose to make it as dynamic as possible in the effort to fully show the scope of my different flavours, you know what I mean?
It's really hard for me, listening to it a couple of times now, it's hard for me to pinpoint sort of a standout track, if you like. But there's one I want to ask you about because it sums up the, as I say, eclectic nature. And it's Poltergeist. It's a really fascinating track, both lyrically, it's so deep, it's just like it blows your mind, but musically it's also fascinating because I kind of, I almost get a, I mean, from my part of the world in the UK, the sort of Ibiza chill out, almost trance electronic music is kind of huge. But yeah. I get some sort of Ibiza chill out there. Is that sort of fair to say? And
The beat has a very smooth, relaxing vibe. But I mean, for me, it's hard for me to even put a description. I'm very curious to hear the feedback from each listener and hear what each person, how each person interprets the project. Because for me, the whole process of making the album was selecting beats from many producers. But each time I heard a beat that really felt like it would be part of the project and I got inspired to write something that fit in with the narrative of the album, I just knew instantly that this had to be in it. So Poltergeist was one of those tracks where I did it in Berlin, and shout out to Dead Rabbit, the producer. He had a lot of beats throwing at me. We did some other projects before, but when I heard this beat, I was like, yo, I need this on my album. And we kind of just built it from there. You know, the chorus is this eerie voice. I think people know me as a deep voice DJ in dancehall. So I'm trying to show people other styles or other sides of my vocal range. And so a lot of times people hear this track and be like, yo, you singing a hook? And I'm like, yeah, it's me, you know. It's just a different song. So, and then the topic is really just a little deep, talking about, you know, overcoming, you know, those spiritual demons, but at the same time making it relevant to people all over the world, from refugees to the ghetto kids of Jamaica, you know what I mean?
Rastafari is a big influence, of course, on your album. It's a big influence in a lot of the revival movement that's coming out of Jamaica. In the UK, we have, I mean, I live in London, and there's a big sort of Rastafari community in London. But in the UK, we historically really have a problem in so much that the community is quite suppressed. It's not recognised. There's generally kind of negative stereotypes around that. That tends to be a UK problem. I personally think it's because the sort of message of the philosophy and the movement is one that the establishment really don't like at all, and they need to keep it down. But on your travels around the world, is that something you've noticed elsewhere, or is the Rastafari movement and its influences more open across the rest of the world?
I think it's respected way more than one would expect around the world. I mean, I don't like to put things on one man's shoulder, but I think Bob Marley has really,
it's hard not to, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I really think he has paved the way for defining Rasta philosophy as, you know, in the term one love, redemption songs, this kind of thing, Africa Unite. So I think people look to a person who is of that Rasta faith as a beacon of hope, of positivity, of, you know, consciousness. And I do agree with you 100%. I think the powers that be are really scared of that. But I think deep down inside, coming back to the shift that I believe is happening, I think there are more people becoming more influential in the establishment who are of that influence as well, who are somewhat conscious. Some may use it to play politics, but I think deep down inside, where we are now compared to 50 years ago, there is way more influence of positivity.
Overall, Holy Temple, what were you aiming for the listener to take away? Because for me, there was overriding themes, and you could feel there was a journey going on. But for me, it kind of, you went through a voyage almost of obviously life, but love, and then loss. But there was also an overriding amount of light in the album. Yeah. I don't know how to describe it, really, apart from light. It was a very... A perfect example, I suppose, is if you... I don't want to compare, so don't take this the wrong way. I'm not making a comparison. But if you compare it to A Matter of Time by Prodigy, which is a fantastic album. I chatted to him last year. staggeringly good album. However, it's extremely dark. It's kind of every song bar one is in a minor key, isn't it? And the themes and the sort of the influences. It's a dark album. Whereas there's overriding light with Holy Temple, and that's for me what I take away from it. And is that the kind of what you'd like people to take away? What were you aiming for people to hear and feel from it?
I don't know if I had one thing for people to take away other than it was more a self-expression. I really look at it like a piece of art. You know, it's really down to the viewer to interpret it how it is. But I just put my heart in putting together a project that I felt fully represented me. For me, you know, my vulnerabilities are on this album. The whole reason why it has taken so long to come up with this album is every stage along the way, I'm a bit of a perfectionist and I kept on with the perfect time and the perfect album and the perfect first single and all of that because of the commercialization of the music industry. But at the same time, for me, all along, from the first song 6 years ago to the release, I've lost so many different friends and family members who have died. And losing, I touch on it in Not Forgotten, losing certain people around me like Little Joe and Delos and Jay Capri and even my family members, Uncle Tony, you know, Xavier, everybody that I've lost around me, Uncle Jimmy, has really brought home this continued rhetoric in my mind, which is that time is a no man. So I was just like, yo, I'm getting this inspiration, I'm feeling this track, I have this track, I'm going to wait until the right time to record it. No, record it, no. Once you die, you don't have the opportunity to share, especially if you didn't record it before, you don't have the opportunity to share whatever that inspiration was and how it may affect someone else. And, you know, it was really, really that kind of led me to say, complete this project and get it out. Don't look at it as something that you're aiming for the highest commercial success, but more something that will stand the test of time. That was it for me. My takeaway is I hope everyone really likes it, or as they listen to it more and more, they really appreciate the depth of it. And it's something that every time you listen to it, you hear something else, like it peeling away layers.
It's a stunning piece of work, basically, and it's. I hope as many people as possible can hear it, because it is essential listening, in my opinion. Basie, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to me. It's been a real pleasure, real privilege to speak to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time and inviting me on. And it's different when you talk to someone and they're just asking you the generic questions, but I really appreciate how you've really gone into the work, and you know, the questions you're asking me in itself is a compliment or something that I'm very humbled and appreciated of. So thank you for checking out the project, thank you for giving me this platform to share the music with other persons, make them more aware of it. And whenever you need anything, just holler at me, you know what I mean? Definitely.
That's very kind of you to say, and it is my pleasure entirely. Basie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, sir.
How amazing is he? And the full interview with Basie will be published along with a review of his album, Holy Temple, separately on The Canary. So do make sure you check that out. In the meantime, here's his fantastic new single and video taken from the album. It is called Poltergeist. Check this shit out. Poltergeist.
Protect us from the poltergeist, as I've been thinking all my life. I was born to live, not born to die. And mama, don't you stress for me, cause in the depths of hell I'll still be having me. I'll forever be fulfilling my destiny.
Me do the one, yeah, for the youth, them on the corner. We grew up without no father, like Tupac and Obama. For my son, them and my daughters, for the sisters and the brothers, for the refugee trying to cross that border. Today may seem darker, but hold on, days are brighter. Tomorrow, filled with more joy and less sorrow. When you're over troubled waters and you feel like life can't get no salter, better must come ask Tom Salter. And that's word to the martyrs, like Martin, Malcolm and what they fought for. To the children, soldiers now in Congo and Somalia. Everyday life is torture, racketeering, extortion. I lift up my hands to the Most High and I ask for inshallah.
Jah watch over us tonight, protect us from the polter guys. Cause I've been thinking all my life, I was born to live, not born to die. And mama, don't you stress for me, cause in the depths of hell I'll still be heavenly. I'll forever be fulfilling my destiny.
Stars from fighting holy wars to the revolutionaries.
And that's it. Episode 11 of Top Rank Caged is done. I would like to thank my fantastic guest this week, the fabulous Paula Peters. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Paula Peters 2. Of course, the sensational Bassie. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Bassie Music. Behind the scenes, I'd like to thank the love of my life, Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. Also, my sound engineer, Gav Pause. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pause with Z Radio. And of course, my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray underscore star 113. Last but not least, thank you to the Canary for encaging me. That's it for this week. I'm off to recover from treading the balls last night. I will see you soon.
Uncaged.